Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by SIGGRAPH Asia 2012, in Singapore from November 28th to December 1st. FX Guide is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. This FX podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, pay respect to the hardworking people who are creating the amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. And be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. This week, Jeff Huser is talking to Andy Beach. Andy is a self-confessed digital media addict who is basically specializes in compression and streaming video. Andy's worked for industry giants such as Microsoft, Apple, and Adobe. He's both got a deep understanding of the technology behind kind of smart and effective video delivery, as well as a lot of expertise in product strategy and the marketing using video compression. FX Guide's Jeff Huser needed to learn more about getting better compression, and simultaneously he ran into Andy at a compression conference. Knowing Andy, of course, from his great published work and his books, Jeff took the opportunity to sit down and geek out about compression, gamma, H.264, X.264, and much, much more. Before we join Jeff for that interview, let me give you a little bit of background for those of you that maybe aren't quite as up to speed on some of the key things that have been happening over the last few years. H.264, probably most of you will know, is one of the world's most widely used codec standards. It's used on Blu-rays and it's used throughout the web. It's often used for streaming video sources, Vimeo, YouTube, iTunes Store. Just to be clear, though, H.264 or MPEG-4 video file format can be delivered in a number of different actual file containers, as you'll hear. So you'll hear M4V or MOV files. These are really just the containers that carry the MPEG-4 plus a bunch of metadata. So each of those .mp4 or MKV or MOV or M4V, all of those are just basically different containers that carry more or less information on how to display the file, and that metadata is defined by that format, as you'll hear Andy explain. And the reason I mention this is you'll also hear Andy talk about X.264. Now, X.264 is an open source, to say open source H.264 encoder. So Apple has its own H.264 encoder, and you'll have seen that on a pop-up menu if you've ever tried doing an export, and you'll see it just says H.264, that's it. Well, the X.264 is a plugin that'll go into QuickTime and allow you to not use Apple's H.264 to encode, but this other open source X.264. And that X.264 will not only allow you to encode differently, but actually provide you with a wealth of basically different options. So when you're doing the heavy lifting at the encoding stage, you have more control, more visibility is accessible to you, the user, which means you can tweak it to get better results. And sometimes you can actually halve the file size by actually bothering to tweak those X.264 settings. Of course, Apple tries to keep H.264 without any kind of user confusion as a really simple, overall sensible setting. And if that's all you want to do, that's fine. But if you're like us and you want to geek out, you may want to go further and look at the open source X.264. And then you'll see a whole host of new flags, options, values, various things that control everything from signal to noise ratio to other things that'll make it better or more specific to the encoding for better playback and same or better file size. You'll also hear Andy mention in this episode 6. If you're not familiar with episode 6, no, we're not talking about Star Wars. We're talking about the Telestream encoder product that actually offers X.264. It retails for about $500 for a single user license, I believe, from telestream.net. Works on Windows and Mac, and I believe the X.264 option is an additional $100. Anyway, we'll cross now to our interview with Jeff Huser and Andy, where he discusses a lot of this and his opinions looking forward to what's coming with H.265.
So I want to talk to you a bunch, Andy, about a whole bunch of topics. I was fascinated by your seminar, which we'll talk, a webinar that I took that we'll talk about later.
Great.
There's a lot of buzzwords right now, cutting the cord, second screen, and you realize that all that stuff leads to compression. And
right.
That's your wheelhouse. So I wanted to talk about your history and how you got into compression as an art form, really.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was originally a lot of people who come into the compression world are originally engineers, and from that background, I was actually a filmmaker. I went to school for film and was an editor, And when I started getting hired in New York originally, it was for jobs that were wanting to do something other than just go back to tape. You know, this was sort of, late 90s, and there was a lot of wanting to create MP3s or QuickTime videos or even starting to get into trying to make DVDs. This was before any DVD burning software really existed, but they were still trying to put them together. And so it became really good to sort of be the guy who knows how to do all this unique stuff with it. And so I just started basically self-teaching on the compression side and seeing where the issues were. And there weren't really, it's not like there were classes on it. It's not like there were even a lot of tools at this point. I think there was one compression program at the time, and then everything else was figure it out yourself, do it through command line. There were even, for color correction, you would literally have to use Photoshop to do changes and then, on individual frames and then re-import them as a QuickTime movie. So, I mean, this was like early scary days of that stuff. And it just kind of started from there and slowly started building to where I began working and teaching at a college in New York, and then caught the eye of a design company that was starting to open up a streaming division. They were working with Apple back in 2000 and 2001 to stream a lot of live concerts in the UK, and I wound up getting hired and starting there in the live side, and then sort of switching back and forth over the next couple of years between that and the on-demand side, and just really learning the codec side, the pre-processing and sort of compression setting side, but then actually getting into, a point where I started catching the eye of the actual software companies designing these tools, and wound up getting hired as a product manager to actually start building the tools. If I was going to complain about them, because I would voraciously complain about the lack of controls, it became a situation of, why don't you build it yourself? And so that's how I got pulled into the software world of actually creating and building the tools and applications that I had been using for years to try and solve these problems.
And that led to the book, Real World Video Compression?
Yeah, so I was actually right about the time I started in my role as a product manager for a compression company. I had been working with a company in New York that was sort of similar to Lynda that put online training up, and we were working with PeachPit on a couple of their books, and we literally just had they were trying to convert some of their titles into online training, and we were having workflow conversations about how to share the edits we were doing with them, and they had specific settings they wanted us to use, and in a meeting online, I sort of explained why they were wrong and why I was right and why I wanted to send it to them this way, and I got a call back, and they were like, you should write a book on that. It sounds like you know what you're talking about. And that's sort of where the idea came from. What I wanted to do with real-world video compression was there were a lot of books at the time that talked about the science of compression and were very, very hard to approach if you're a producer or even an editor who's technical, but technical in a different world. They don't really have any help for the compression problem you're having. And so I wanted something that was like the plain English language version of all of that. What are all those big scary terms, and how do you break them down into something that actually might give you some context for what your issue and your problem is, and then apply those to some specific apps of the day. Where that came from.
I noticed that it seems like the kind of book that things change so fast that as soon as you write it, it's like you've got to update it. So I noticed you have a website, a companion.
I do. I have a website called realworldvideocompression.com. I don't post there nearly as much as I used to. I've actually also started a second website called The Video Uprising. A lot of the work that I've been doing in the last couple of years has moved away from the desktop applications, and it's more about the video infrastructure delivering all of that streaming content. And so I thought, rather than try to slam the two topics together, I would sort of separate them out, and I would use the Video Uprising as a place where I could sort of talk about the trends that are going on with how Netflix is delivering their content to us, or why a company like Cisco might be involved in video because it's such a heavy data usage on the network. So things like that.
Yeah, we were just at a talk by the guy from Roku, and he mentioned that like 55% of all internet traffic by 2016 was one of the Cisco metrics that they're looking at is it will be video traffic.
Right.
And it's growing at such an amazing rate. And he made the point that the adoption rate is not just early adopters, and it's not just, you know, tech guys. It's everybody. It's because they're making their box really simple. It just plugs in. You got access to all this content. And so it's definitely a huge part of the business. That makes sense.
Oh, yeah. I use my Guidestone. Everybody has, like, the non-techie person in their lives that they use as, like, the mile marker. And mine's my father-in-law. And my father-in-law now has an iPhone and watches Netflix movies on that, even when he's sometimes sitting in a den with his giant flat-screen TV, because it's so easy to use. And he doesn't want to deal with, you know, turning on everything. And so if he's just sitting by himself quietly, you know, reading the paper and drinking coffee, he'll turn on a Netflix movie and watch it that way. And that, to me, is an indicator that, like, everybody must be doing this now. Because if this guy can figure it out, who can't figure out how to work his printer?
Right.
That's amazing.
No, it's fascinating. Well, I learned about you because of research I was doing. Obviously, one of the biggest things visual effects people have to deal with is our clients live on the net, and we have to post work for them.
Right.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about the Moviola webinars. Wow, that's a mouthful. Because I watched one called Encoding High-Quality Video with X264 and found it really great. Can you talk to me a little bit about those webinars and what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. So Moviola is, they actually acquired a company called, I believe it was called Filmmaking Webinars or something like that. That was started a couple of years ago, but they bought it about a year ago, maybe. And it's a great online portal for a variety of different topics. They get subject matter experts that are working professionals in the world to come on and do short classes about their specific areas. So since I do compression, those have always been the focus of mine. And I've done what I try to do is not just a collection of, like, you know, here's some settings and go do something. I try to, provide some context around why it is that way, or try to explain some of the settings and why it will affect differently as you start tweaking and adjusting it. And so the most recent one that I did really highlighted, because high quality has become such an issue, a particular codec called X264 was really the main focus. And X264 is just a variant of H.264, which more of us are familiar with, but it's a specific version of X264. So I explained that in the webinar and then show some of the different programs that you can use it in. One of the newest happens to be Episode 6 that has a plugin for it, but I also use a variety of others just so that, depending on what your workflow is, there's a way you can approach it and use it.
Yeah, I found it really interesting because I landed on X264 kind of by accident and found that I really liked it. But I, you know, as you say, there's a billion settings in there.
And
the webinar was really helpful in terms of going through some of those and explaining why you would want to use this or why you wouldn't, and brought up issues like, well, if you turn this on, it's probably going to fail on portable devices, you know,
right,
things like that. That's all very, very interesting information. And
The thing about X264 that is different and that why it's so popular amongst particularly compressionists and compression geeks out there is that it really exposes and peels back all of those advanced settings. All those settings are there in H.264 too, but they're hidden from the user. When you set other things, it will change under the hood the different settings that will be in place, but those are actually there and still being used to a certain degree. What they've done in X264 is they've exposed all of that to the end user so that you can go in and very infinitesimally touch and tweak and change how different things are going to be handled. And the reason that becomes important is, depending on the type of content you have, you're going to want to have very subtle changes. You know, if it's film grain content or natural video content or animation, those are very different settings that you might want to have under the hood as to how they're going to be encoded and treat each of the frames individually, that will all give you the perfect quality that you're looking for with the lowest possible bitrate.
And that was one of the things you pointed out in the seminar, was that X264 can give you a better quality at a lower file size,
right,
as well.
Yep.
Besides being more accessible to the settings, but that was the other reason people liked it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And was compatible with all the H.264 decoders.
The decoders, right. It'll still play back. It's not like it's a special plugin to go play these back. You know, the one area you have to be careful about is that because you have access to all these advanced settings, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and it's very easy to put combinations of settings together that will cause a piece of video to suddenly not play back on a given device if you tweak it too far. And that's one of the, you know, the caveats or the things they have to be cautious about as you start exploring it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times people try to find the magic recipe that they think works for everything, and you know, I mean, I've experienced where all of a sudden you're working on a spot that's extremely dark and lots of neon colors, and wow, that's completely different. You're going to have to crank everything way up to get that through just by the nature of it, or fast moving, or, you know, everything just varies so much. And for the most part, I think you can come up with, it seems to me like you can come up with a pretty basic setup that you can use for most things. But I do think people have to understand more than is easily available. And I got to say, there's not as much information out there on all this as I was hoping when I started digging into this. I was thrilled when I found you because I was like, oh my God, there's just not a lot out there.
Yeah, I think, you know what, I think part of the problem with it is that it, you know, they always used to call compression like the dark art, right? That's kind of what it always got referred to. And part of it is that there is no single secret recipe, like you're saying. It's knowing the conditions, you know, what's right for this video, this type of video, you know, what's right for this type of video, and being able to sort of apply those, you know, start with a baseline and then start moving from there based on what you're seeing. That's the secret, really. You know, it's progressing through it. But then every few years it changes. So documenting it, what happens is the documentation falls out of date pretty quickly. Just like you mentioned with my book, like I'm sometimes surprised that copies of it are still selling out there because it's like 4 years old now, and like there was no adaptive bitrate video when I wrote that book, and that's what everybody does now is HLS video for the iPhone, and that wasn't possible when I wrote the book, and so there's no settings in there for that because there's no way to help you with it, and so. So it's changing so quickly that it's hard to stay on top of the documentation in a way, and it's hard to know if you're reading up to date documentation when you're getting it off the web. And so,
and we don't want to be in that business, really.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the problem is we, you know, I mean, we don't have time to be in that business. It's a full time thing chasing, keeping up with that knowledge. So, you know, I guess that's where we have to hope that the manufacturers like Telestream and Sorensen and people like that are doing best as they can to help us with that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what's great about applications like that across the board, all of them, is that the presets and the settings are good starting places, you know, and rarely do I ever just run a piece of video through with just the vanilla settings, but they're a good starting point. And what I kind of always liked about episodes is that they tend to update them pretty aggressively. Like even between big point updates, I've noticed that the presets will get a refresh where they've retuned the settings. And that's great to see that kind of attention to it, because that's the kind of stuff that becomes important when you're working with this stuff, because that means you're not having to keep up to date with, like, what are the standard screen sizes and bit rates per screen size for these various things. They're kind of doing that, and then you can adjust and customize and tweak based off of what you're seeing.
Right. Yeah, it's a very frustrating world in the post-production community, I think, right now, because, you know, we used to get very specific requests for deliveries.
Yeah.
And now we'll get a list sometime that's a whole page of, you know, we need a ProRes of this, we need this for YouTube, we need this. And some of them don't even have specifications about what that means. You know, what do they consider acceptable for YouTube? What do they consider, you know, or you get an unusual request for some bitrate that you're like, you really want that? Why would you want that? What are you going to do with it?
Right. Yeah, I always, one of the things that when I was really more of a professional compressionist and just encoding content for people, I would always push back and say, you know, okay, here's the list of what you want. Tell me where you're using these. Because, you know, I would want to suggest, like, okay, this is what you're asking for. I think this is what you really want. You know, please, you know, verify, you know. And, you know, you can't always do that. Sometimes you just have to deliver the crazy thing. But,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it is what it is. I also used to make a much bigger deal about, you know, the trying to make sure I always had the highest quality, you know, source. Because, you know, it was really hard, you know, especially back in the ye olde days to get decent quality, because we were dealing with, you know, standard def tape, or, you know, at times you'd even be sent VHS tapes to encode stuff off of. And so it would just be horrible. And, you know, trying to make sure that that you were setting their expectations, by saying, look, it's got to be these versions, and if you can't provide it, it's hard to guarantee the quality that you're going to see coming out the other side.
Yeah, and the number of times we get requests for 2997 content, everything's at 2398, and they don't want... They don't want pull down.
Right.
And I'm like, well, why do you want this at 2997 to put it on the web? I'm confused by that.
Right. It's because they heard one time somewhere, you know, that they think they know a guy who said that's what it should be.
Yeah. So talk to me about extensions a little bit. Let's back up a little bit. One of the biggest problems I think we've faced as an industry in the post-production side has been this constant fight with Gamma and things like that. Mm-hmm. It seems like that's died down a little bit, and I don't know whether people just got used to it or if there's been some other changes that have helped that.
So it was kind of an operating system bug. Not a bug, but they were just fundamental differences in the way older versions of Macs and older versions of the Windows operating system treated the luminosity on the screen. They ran at different gamma numerically. And that became a problem when we started playing back video on the web, because it suddenly meant that one was going to be muddy or one was going to be bright. But you were not going to, what you kind of had to do is you kind of had to make a kind of in-between crappy-ish version if you just wanted both people to be, about the same amount of disappointed with the experience. And so this was really more of like a pre Windows XP type problem. Basically with the later versions of XP, and then in 7, they've adjusted their gamma. OS 10, I believe, also did some updates to how they treat gamma. And so now, effectively, this problem has more or less gone away. It was also more specific to CRTs, which we're using a lot less on computers. It's almost all flat screens and laptop screens now. So I think that's really affected the issue. And I think we've kind of moved on. There's so much content out there now that we're dealing with the flow of it rather than the individual pieces and picking them apart. Because I certainly still see some bad encodes show up. The thing that always, it's not even the color one I almost give away, because that one's hard. It's just tough to get color conversion right when you're doing this. I'm shocked when I see bad deinterlacing on professional. I've seen it on Netflix and I've seen it on Amazon where it's the pull down wasn't pulled out correctly, and you see weird banding and other issues, and it's like, I can't believe that stuff is still in there,
Yeah. Well, it's equally as frustrating in the broadcast world, where you deliver HD commercials and, start seeing them at center cut, right. Standard def on the air, and you're like, why? It's a HD program, how does it get to this? How do we end up with this? I mean, it's a mess everywhere. Still, you'd think it'd be getting easier, but it never is.
My favorite is there's a set of commercials that play on during the morning news. They always play during when the Today Show's on, but it's the local commercial, and it's anamorphically compressed, and they just play it back. It's still anamorphically compressed.
You wonder how you can go through day after day like that.
But. Right. After 30 times of watching it, I have this strong desire to call the TV. station and complain.
Have you ever tried that, though? It doesn't work.
I know. Well, that's what stops me. It's like, how would I even begin to explain that?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been on both ends of that, and it doesn't happen. Can you talk a little bit about extensions? I know that sometimes some people say, I should post everything in MP4 instead of MOV and what that does.
Sure. So in general, the file extension is really... For the most part, it's just the computer's way of deciding which program is going to open it up. For example, Apple has adopted the .m4v as their specific take on an MPEG-4 video file. And they also use M4A for their audio files that are all tied to iTunes. That does slightly change, though, with each of those, the file format is basically the container. It's the vessel that has all of the information in it, the video, the audio, but then all this other metadata. And the metadata is like how the computer is supposed to treat the video and the audio once it's opened it up. Or it could be other things like closed captioning or secondary audio or that kind of thing. And so the container can have a variety of information, and depending on that file extension, it could treat... It'll help tell the computer which information to expect and what to do with it. The most basic one is .mp4. That's sort of just the basic fundamental, MPEG-4 video, sort of the industry standard one. And as such, it tends to have sort of the the least amount of information that necessarily carries over with it. For example, you know, we were talking earlier that it doesn't typically have, I don't believe it actually has the ability to carry color stream information. So it wouldn't carry like color adjustment information about how to display it differently with different color values. Whereas a .mov file does. A .mov file actually has a lot of additional metadata that it can carry in the container. Not just, you know, things like color information, but, you know, things about like how to play the sound back, in different audio patterns and whatnot. And so all that kind of stuff can be carried in the file format or in the container, and what that file extension is will help the computer make the decision as to what the default app is that's going to play it back and parse it. You know, a lot of the video apps are flexible in being able to play back a variety of apps or a variety of file types, but they typically have one or two that are the ones that they play back the best. And so depending on what devices you're targeting, that's going to help you decide what kind of file format you want to use, because that may affect your what container you ultimately want to put it in. If you're a really Mac-heavy crowd, you may just want to use an MOV because it's easy, it's there, the system knows how to use it extremely well. If you're targeting a lot of mobile devices or you just want the sort of the widest audience, you probably just want to stick to that MP4 because you know that it's going to play back on virtually any device from a really simple feature phone to definitely a smartphone, and then any laptop, and then even a few DVD players out there. So, I mean, that's going to get you your broadest one. But then if you're targeting like a specific set of information that you need to carry over, or you need subtitles or other things embedded in it, then you may want one of the more unique ones out there, like an MKV file or something else. So it's all about what you need for the device your audience is intending to watch the content on.
And that's a big problem because it can be a wide range. I mean, when we post work for a client, it could easily be that they double-click it and they want to look at it in the QuickTime.
Right.
Or, you know, they want to look at it on their phone or on an iPad, for example. And we've done testing with the iPads and stuff and been kind of surprised with the newer ones how close to color they are just out of the box. Not a wide sample. This is just anecdotally kind of we tested it. And I just recently bought one of those Spider things, and it can calibrate the iPads and the iPhone. Wow. I was surprised. I didn't know it would do that. But there's an app, and you hook it up to your computer, and it did seem to make a difference. It seems like, you know, I like the way my laptop looks now after using it much better. I mean, I've been through all the little make Apple disappear type settings and thought I was doing the right thing, and then I calibrated it and went, oh, it's a lot different than that. Nicer. But anyway, it's just we have no control. And I mean, I am assuming that there's even differences in the way movies are presented sometimes if they're in a browser as opposed to standalone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talked about the anamorphic stuff. One of the metadata flags that will be in the container is, you know, whether it needs to be presented in the current pixel resolution or whether it needs to be stretched in some way for display. And that can be overridden by things like browser plugins. And so you have to be all conscious and aware of that. And you kind of have to, you know, you have to be overeducated in it because you need to be sort of almost pre-troubleshooting in a way the people you're sending the files to, particularly for like review processes. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I always try to, when I was doing this full time, I always tried to make sure that when I sent it out, I reminded them, like, you know, if you're going to review it, you know, review it in the context of how it's intended to play back. Or, you know, if you're just testing it in a browser or through QuickTime or whatever, just remember that it's going to look slightly different. You know, I would always send those warnings along. You know, people probably got tired of me saying it, as a matter of fact.
Well, what would your recommendation be for, like, best practices for people in terms of, like, I mean, is there a checklist that people could think of in terms of, like, what they need to check their content for to make sure that it, you know, I mean, it's almost to the point where you can't buy all the devices, you can't,
right,
and you can't take the time to even test it on all the devices. You kind of have to come up with some best practices and stick with them and deal with exceptions as they arise, I guess.
Sure. It's, you know, it's in terms of best practices, the one that I've always done that I think is best is that the settings that are good today aren't necessarily going to be good tomorrow. So the quality thing becomes a moving target. So even if I'm happy with the settings that I use, I still reevaluate them basically every 6 months. And, you know, because 6 months, within 6 months, at least one new device will have probably crept into my life. I'll have either a new laptop or a tablet or a TV or a monitor or something that I wasn't playing video on before. So I have sort of a standard. I have my videos that are like literally just live in Dropbox that are basically some ProRes clips that I have that are like my compression killers, you know, some like 1080p HD content that I always know that I can do a referencing code from and look at them and say, okay, what's this look like on this device? What's it look like on this device? And so I'm just testing the devices in my life, but not necessarily every device out there. But
that's a really good suggestion, though. I know I do that myself. I keep little short clips of things that were particularly gnarly, color-wise or compression-wise.
And I figure that if I can make those look good on the various devices at the bit rates that I think are good, then anything else that I hit throw at those settings is going to probably be great. But then I'm always reevaluating those because the bandwidth sort of requirements change. You know, we've been able to up the bit rates on things dramatically in the last couple of years because data rates have improved. We're getting away with a lot more, whereas we used to have to really, really try and crank down the data rates. We're able to open that up a little more, and that really starts to improve and affect what you can do. You know, that trade-off is that we're also trying to make the actual resolutions of the files much bigger. So it's tricky. So I think reevaluating and just sort of constantly, you know, on a routine basis, every 6 months or at least once a year, do a check-in with your settings. You know, re-encode a batch of things, look at it on whatever devices you've got, and then do a mild tweak, see if they're any better, and if they are, just document it. Use those as the new ones moving forward until you make it. And I literally keep sort of, I still have my sort of standard, you know, this is what I think looks good on the iPod, this is what I think looks good on my Nexus tablet, this is what looks good on my laptop. I just got a new Windows 8 laptop that I'm going to have to go run through and do some settings to see what I think looks good playing back on it full screen, because it's a bigger resolution screen than I've had on any of my other laptops. So
where would people go to find like information about this kind of things? Like, is it more just experimentation? And but I mean, are there any sites that you know of or that could be helpful with that?
Oftentimes, I mean, if you're a lot of times you can find settings from people, or you can find them starting to see, often you'll see the settings that are baked into Episode or Handbrake. Those are good starting points. And then it becomes a question of tuning them to your specific type of content, you know, because you may have very specific needs around lighting or graphics or something else that may not be taken account for. So those are kind of good starting places. Rarely do I see places online. I mean, I've got a variety of settings on my website that I've put up for different devices, but I think they stopped. You know, the last ones I probably did were around maybe the new iPad and the screen resolution for it. So
while we're at it, where would people find that?
So you can go to rwvc.tv or realworldvideocompression.com. They both relink to the same place, but I got tired of typing the long URL.
I know that well. What about the future? Where are we heading? I hear about H.265. Is that, I know that's still...
It's a thing. It is.
Evolving, but...
Yeah, absolutely. So H.264 is actually, even though for some people it may be a brand new thing that they're talking and thinking about, it's actually been around for years now. It's probably nearly 10 years old, or maybe even slightly older, from a draft perspective as to when it
was. Wasn't it originally like a conferencing spec or something?
So H.263, the predecessor, was a spec for video conferencing. And they, when they updated it to H.264 years ago for the quality improvements and the data sizes, that didn't get adopted for web conferencing, but it was ideal for playback of video on these variety of devices we were starting to see hit the market. The goal of any, you know, the way a codec comes into existence is that groups of engineers from a variety of companies contribute to these boards. MPEG is one of them. But there are a couple different standards boards out there, and those boards are even working together to jointly agree that, you know, to basically write in draft form, this is the goal of this codec. This is what we want to see it do. And, you know, sort of a high, you know, a high level what do you call it, the high-level goal that they have with any new draft that they would put together is that they want to, you know, keep the same quality with half the bitrate. Or effectively, you know, double the quality that you would see at a given bitrate.
Which is with the statistics climbing so fast on the adoption of video, on the percentage of usage of the video on internet, I'm sure that's a big goal for people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, part of the reason they want to do that is that we're constantly pushing up the video resolution size, which means that you're having to dramatically push up the data rates that would support those. And so they're trying to, you know, keep on par with what it'll do. They're also trying to expand the upper ceiling of what resolutions a given piece of video would support, because, you know, even H.264 has limits. I believe it will only go up to 4K, but they want to have something that will support beyond that, because the goal of a codec is that it has a long lifespan. And so one of the additional, you know, on top of that high level sort of quality issue we had talked about, is that they do want to push the resolution, I believe, up to 8K with H.265. But so it's a new codec. It's been in draft form. I believe it has been approved, or at least the first draft of it was approved. And we'll start seeing, you know, what that means then is that the various companies have a spec that they can go away and create a version of the codec with. And so we'll start seeing the companies that create the codecs, people like Main Concept, Dicus is another one. There's a variety. Sorensen actually also, I believe, creates a few codecs of their own. All those companies will go away with the spec and create their version, their flavor of H.265. But because they all have an agreed draft that they were starting from, they should all interoperate and work.
Gotcha.
So,
do you think that'll play with existing H.264? I mean, I know that a lot of hardware has been optimized for H.264.
Sure. So, with a new codec, there will be a new decoder as well, and so there'll have to be an H.265 decoder that starts getting baked into new appliances and new devices. So it's not something that immediately, you know, that's why these things are slow to roll out, and that's why we're talking about it in the industry and we're starting to play with it. But it won't be something in the marketplace for another couple of years that, you know, from a consumer perspective, is really worried about. But it is effectively a new player and a new thing that's going to be added. Of course, that's easy to do in the software world because it's just a, you know, software or firmware upgrade. For hardware, it's going to be a little more challenging and a little trickier, and it'll be something that takes a longer time to roll out.
Gotcha. Well, where would people find you if they wanted to find you on the net?
I have a couple different places. I can be found on thevideouprising.com. I'm contributing there fairly regularly. I still do, when people ask me questions on realworldvideocompression.com, I try to post answers as blog posts just to make sure that I'm answering it for everybody, because I figure if one person asks, probably a dozen people really want to know it. And then I can also be found on Twitter under slash Andy Beach, or at Andy Beach. That's probably the main places people could find me today if they have questions or want to find out more about this.
Cool. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for that, Jeff. And thanks also to Andy Beach. And the URL is realworldvideocompression.com. In addition to this FX podcast you've been listening to, we have two other audio podcasts you might like to check out. One is The VFX Show, which regularly reviews visual effects in current release films, as well as some retro classic films. And then the RC podcast, which covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. If you've enjoyed this podcast, I also suggest you check out our HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. Plus, we have a host of really cool online training for visual effects, editing, color correcting, and more over at our sister site, fxphd.com. Well, that's it for this ep. On behalf of my partners, John Montgomery and Jeff Huser, thanks so much for listening. See ya.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.